Hey there! Did you know Kroger always gives you savings and rewards on top of our lower-than-low prices? And when you download the Kroger app, you'll enjoy over $500 in savings every week with digital coupons. And don't forget fuel points to help you save up to $1 per gallon at the pump. Want to save even more? With a Boost membership, you'll get double fuel points and free delivery. So shop and save big at Kroger today. Kroger, fresh for everyone. Savings may vary by state. Restrictions apply. See site for details.
Hello, everybody. This is Marshall Poe. I'm the founder and editor of the New Books Network. I've published several academic books, and one of the things I found frustrating is my inability to get them picked up in the press. There really is no PR service specifically oriented toward academic books. Recently, however, I had the opportunity to work with a PR firm in New York, RLM, on a book that I recently published. And I have to say, they did a remarkable job at a very low price. And this got me thinking, I wonder if the New Books Network and RLM could provide a service that would promote academic books. So the folks at RLM and I put our heads together and we came up with a package. It is specifically targeted toward people like you, people who write academic books. So if you're interested, you should go to the NBN website and click publish your book, and there you'll find some information about the services that the NBN and RLM are offering. What we really want to do is provide you with value for money. As far as we know, no such service exists. This is the first of its kind, and we really hope it is successful, and we hope that it helps you get the word out about your academic book.
Welcome to the New Books Network.
Hello and welcome to another episode on the New Books Network. I'm one of your hosts, Dr. Miranda Melcher, and I'm very intrigued today about the book we get to talk about with its author, Dr. Nick Jones, because it's something that is both part of, I think, many of our everyday, most of our days, but also something we don't necessarily talk or think that much about. The book is titled GUI Media, Screen Entertainment and the Graphic User Interface, published by Edinburgh University Press, and without giving too much away, investigates the graphic user interface, not necessarily so much the technical side, which, fair enough, we kind of know that piece, but what is it doing to us? How do we think about it? Where is it being taken in different forms of media? So lots to get into here. Nick, thanks so much for being with us.
Thanks for having me. Really great to be here.
Could you start us off, please, by introducing yourself a little bit and explain why you decided to write this book?
Sure. So I'm a lecturer at the University of York in the UK. I've been here for a few years. I teach across a couple of undergraduate degree programs. One of them is film and television production, and the other one is interactive media. So one of them is film and TV, and one of them is kind of more focused on video games, websites, digital culture, that sort of thing. And over the last few years of teaching across these two modules, I wanted to work on a project that kind of brought these things together, that focused on the overlaps and the connections rather than keeping kind of film TV analysis on one side and kind of discussions of digital culture, video games on another side. So I was really interested, in pulling these things together somehow, and previous work that I'd done around sort of commercial Hollywood cinema and then digital 3D and VFX sort of started slightly moving in this direction. But then, I sort of two or three years ago, it was during just before the pandemic started, I started thinking that there was some mileage in a project around the graphic user interface. I'd done a couple of other pieces of research, journal articles that seemed to kind of be working in the same territory as each other and pointing towards something around sort of digital aesthetics. And so I sort of spent some time with them and thinking about what kind of broader ideas they connected to. And then thankfully that kind of ballooned into this much bigger project around the graphic user interface and kind of how it affects other media and all other media, a kind of wide array, not just sort of the graphic user interface and cinema, but the graphic user interface as it relates to cinema, television, video games, apps, and then even things like architecture and matter itself, sort of trying to get a bit more kind of ambitious and slightly strange with the thinking as the book sort of goes on, rather than just zeroing in on a kind of reasonably narrow array of concerns. So that was the kind of plan for the book. And I also wanted to write something that was a little more, I don't know, I never know whether I should say this, because then people might read the book and say, like, well, you failed. Try and write something that was a little bit more playful and a little bit more possibly even fun than previous academic work that I had done, which I've always felt the need, like, to prove something. This needs to prove that it's, you know, it's worth studying digital 3D. So you've got to take it really seriously and really apply sort of rigorous theory and make it seem ironclad. And for this one, I just thought, I want it to be good work, obviously. I want it to have that ballast, but I also want it to have a sense of fun and kind of freedom to it. And hopefully that makes it more reader-friendly and approachable, especially for students, but also for anyone else, but just a piece of kind of contemporary screen media theory, which treads lightly but deeply somehow, I think was the goal.
No, thank you for giving us that background. I think it's very helpful to kind of know what your goals are with a book going into a discussion on it, and of course, kind of what led you into it. And it's that kind of aspect of the film studies side of things that I think I want to kind of pick up on first. I mean, you've given me so many things to ask you about, but let's go there first. You talk about in the book that we need to, quote, move our gaze from the cinema to the desktop interface. Given how we might tend to think about screens, and given especially kind of the background in film studies, can you tell us about this statement?
Sure, yeah. And yeah, my own background is film studies. That was my PhD was in film studies, and then kind of branching out into spatial theory, but done in a film department. And a lot of the kind of media theory out there is very kind of cinema focused, or a particular body of it is cinema focused when thinking about kind of aesthetics and composition and images and kind of how those have developed in the 20th century and have changed in the 21st century. There's a sort of contemporary body of work around sort of post-cinema that looks at digital media as being post-cinematic. And there's some really great stuff there, but it still centers cinema in a way which I thought maybe it's more productive to kind of step beyond that and to try and think in sort of slightly different terms. So, and I think there's a kind of longer history there where, for good or ill, this idea of cinema and the cinematic is kind of foregrounded. It's centralized in media culture, in popular discourse. You know, if we want to describe a TV show or a video game as being particularly impressive, maybe in its production value or its kind of ambition, then we describe it as cinematic. It's this value judgment that raises up kind of other media often. And that all just seems a bit sort of problematic, especially as we get kind of further and further into this era where so much of our media is consumed via the graphic user interface. So we have this kind of one screen which provides us, yeah, our films, our cinema. We may go and see them. We may pay money for a ticket, but we'll also most likely watch a fair bit of stuff on Netflix or various other streaming services, and we'll also be watching television on Netflix on our laptops, possibly on our smartphones and other devices. So it felt like the kind of fundamental, the center of media culture, kind of to think of it as cinema, felt a bit of a kind of relic. Even if you're centering cinema by saying, like, we're post-cinematic, there's still a kind of implicit focus on cinema as this kind of center of gravity. And so I was trying to, like, well, what if we shift our center of gravity and think about the desktop interface as being the thing which is kind of influencing the way a lot of our media work, not just the way we consume it, but the way that they are produced, the way that they look and sound. So that was kind of the goal, and that's kind of what that quote is pointing to. Yeah, kind of trying to encourage this shift of perspective, which then allows for so many other kind of media to be brought into conversation in a way which doesn't have a sense of hierarchy to it. Mm-hmm. So you can talk about cinema alongside video games, television, apps, other things, YouTube content, in a way that doesn't sort of place cinema above those and just have those others kind of understood through the lens of cinema. If you kind of take cinema off that pedestal and instead use the GUI as the lens, then yeah, all of these media, all of this content kind of exists in a more flattened hierarchy, which, you know, some people may disagree with, but that was kind of the approach, was to try and put everything on the same level.
Mm. No, thank you for taking us through that. I think that helps give us a foundation in terms of scope and in terms of lens. So very useful to understand that. Similarly, in the sort of foundation-ish, I suppose, section, I know the book is, to me at least, thankfully, not a sort of technological investigation of exactly how a GUI works. But it would, I think, be helpful to know some of that, I guess less on the sort of electrons bit and more on the kind of where does this come from and how has it developed?
Sure. Yeah. And I'm not a technical person. I have many colleagues who teach various forms of practice, including aspects of coding. And that is not me. I can't do that sort of stuff. Perhaps the book would be stronger if I did have more of a background in that, but I don't.
I mean, someone who's non-technical, I wouldn't be able to read it if it was. So, right.
Exactly. In terms of first principles, like I've been talking about the graphic user interface. What is that? Essentially, every device that we use these days, laptops, phones, even some smartwatches, have an interface that allows us to access their functions, whether that's, you know, kind of various programs or the internet or whatever. And that interface is overwhelmingly a graphic user interface. So other interfaces are available, but not used very often. And a graphic user interface is this way of the user interfacing with the system, which uses graphics. I know it sounds simple, but so that's where the title comes from, as opposed to a command line interface. So a command line interface is just text. So you're dealing with the computer, you're telling the computer to do certain things by typing in text. And anyone who's seen like a kind of MS-DOS screen will know what this looks like. And so the graphic user interface sort of replaces the command line interface in sort of the 80s and beyond, allowing computers to be much more user-friendly to a wide audience. So yeah, I couldn't use MS-DOS, certainly not reliably, for very long. Whereas a graphic user interface, because it doesn't rely on people understanding exactly what the language is that they need to input into the computer with the right colons, the right slashes, the right hash keys, and all of that, you don't need any of that because the graphic user interface is representational. It's pictorial, it's pictures. You can click on an icon of a document and you can drag it into an icon of a folder. And intuitively, you know that you have moved where the computer is storing that document into that folder that you've just dragged it into. So rather than having to type that out as a kind of coded instruction, you get to do it kind of intuitively. You get to kind of use your hands, even if it's kind of through a screen, but using the mouse, you're kind of picking up an object and dropping it. And likewise, any other kind of repositioning of windows or commands that you give a computer, it's all happening kind of graphically. So that's when we talk about a graphic user interface, any interface that has this kind of pictorial quality, as well as the kind of sonic features that comes with that. As I say, this kind of arose in so the 70s, 80s, replacing the command line interface that had been dominant before then. Some key kind of places, Xerox PARC was a key place where the graphic user interface was kind of developed, and then Apple computers borrowed or stole a lot of their work around kind of creating this sort of graphic space. And then really interestingly, something that I found during the research of the book that was to me an absolute gift was discovering that there was this lawsuit in the late 80s, early 90s, where Microsoft were also developing a graphic user interface, which did sort of similar things. to the one that Apple had at the time, and Apple tried to sue them. Apple said, you're stealing our ideas. This is our intellectual property, the idea of icons that work this way, of windows that can be repositioned, and various other kind of features. Apple said, these are ours. And Microsoft said, no, they're not. It's a graphic user interface. That's not proprietary. That's not your kind of, it's not a product that you can own. That is a kind of media form. Like no one owns the copyright to cinema. It's a media form, although you can own the copyright to, you know, a particular manifestation of cinema, i.e. a specific film. So Apple lost that lawsuit. The judge ruled that the graphic user interface was this kind of more broad media form that everyone could kind of utilize with its various features of kind of organization of folders, of icons, of customization of kind of windows, all that sort of stuff. So that to me is a really fascinating kind of moment in the early 90s where the legal establishment kind of decided that a graphic user interface was public property and was this kind of almost default aesthetic organizational approach for how we deal with computer data, for how we're going to manage our lives on computers, which then, of course, as we go through the 90s and into the 21st century, digital systems and kind of engaging with online networks becomes so crucial to almost everything that we do or that many of us do. So a really kind of interesting moment that allowed the graphic user interface to then become this sort of standard operating system for how people deal with computers, engage with computers, which then, now it's kind of inescapable. And as you said in your introduction, it's so prevalent, it's so present that we just don't see it because it's just what we expect when we open up a computer. We expect to see a graphic user interface, and therefore we pay attention to what we then want to do. How do I open Netflix? How do I get this Microsoft Word doc open? How do I access this file? We're not thinking about the interface itself. We're thinking, what do I want to do using this interface? Because it's the air we breathe now. It's just so prevalent. That's a kind of a bit of kind of definition of the graphic user interface and kind of how it's developed, where it's come from a bit.
What a great find, kind of, to have such a specific legal case to really encapsulate this and kind of show where it comes from. So thank you for taking us through that. Given obviously in that instance, there's already a very clear kind of transference from one company to others. It's moving across from where it was originally created. And as towards the end of that question, you were talking about the air we breathe, right? It's everywhere now. Can you tell us about some examples of how it's been mirrored in other media if we continue moving not just from one company to another, but really quite far beyond that?
Yeah, of course. So I think if we jump ahead to kind of the 2010s, one of the most overt ways in which the GUI is mirrored in other media is in a kind of mode of media presentation that we might call, like, if it's a film, we might call it desktop cinema. And there's been a bit of kind of writing about this, and I think that's a reasonably accepted definition. I think perhaps you can Wikipedia desktop cinema and you get a page, which is to say films that take place on the desktop, which are entirely kind of, you know, we don't see other things. We're just locked into a desktop. We see the characters through webcams, through security CCTV footage. We watch them type emails. We see them speak to other people on Skype and FaceTime and all that stuff. So films like Unfriended and its sequel, Searching, Missing, Profile, Spree, they all have these kind of names that are drawn from kind of social media and online culture. So these are these kind of great kind of tip of the iceberg texts that show us, look, you know, the graphic user interface is being kind of ripped away wholesale or taken wholesale and kind of quoted, borrowed, used as the kind of diegesis of an entire film. And then there are other media that are also doing this. So films are kind of the ones that I was thinking about first and came across first, but then as you start kind of researching this, there's loads of video games that do this as well. So the work of Sam Barlow, which people might be aware of, games like Telling Lies, Immortality, where the player is given access to a graphic user interface and the gameplay is kind of investigation. You are opening documents, opening folders, you're tracking through old email chains, and the goal is to kind of find connections and discover the narrative, but the shape of the game, the space of the game, is a graphic user interface, and that's how it's being kind of delivered to the game player. And then there's also increasingly documentaries and sort of web-based documentaries that do this, and sort of things that texts that are kind of on the borderline between what we might call a documentary and what we might call a video essay. So Kevin B. Lee's quite well-known or reasonably kind of widely seen piece, Transformers the Premake, is this excellent 20-minute video that takes place entirely on the desktop as he kind of goes through the way a specific Transformers film has been made in this kind of global production network and how fans have engaged with it. There's another one called My Mulholland by Jessica McGough, which is, again, entirely on her desktop and exploring the film Mulholland Drive and her own kind of reaction to that, but also kind of the rise of a certain kind of niche of internet culture and kind of our experiences online and what that's kind of doing to us socially. So there's all these kind of different media forms that are just quoting the GUI and using the GUI to tell their stories, to do their work, to kind of frame their gameplay. And I think that those examples alone, even though we might argue that it's a relatively niche form, some people might refer to it as a gimmick or a novelty, although I wouldn't. Even just those examples show us how kind of fundamental, how embedded the GUI is, because it's being kind of quoted wholesale by these other media, and they're able to, they're still able to kind of tell stories. It's still able to be kind of really successful video games. No one's complaining about the kind of limitations of the GUI. The GUI actually kind of, the constraints of it are what then make the media interesting in a lot of ways. And also it allows these texts to be reflections upon our relationship to the graphic user interface in really interesting ways. Even a horror film like Unfriended, about a ghost invading a Skype call and killing the teenagers who are on the Skype call one by one. We might pass that off as kind of, sensational horror, but actually it's telling us a lot about how we kind of think about online digital culture and kind of the fears around it, the uncertainty, the kind of specters that we might find within social media and all of the stuff that we kind of access through the graphic user interface. So those are kind of, like I say, the tip of the iceberg examples, but the book isn't just about them. There was a moment where I thought, that could be the focus of the entire book, but there seem to be so many more interesting places you can go with it if you start to kind of step past these, take these as the most overt examples of a much more extensive process of kind of borrowing and intermingling, even if the other examples are less overt. If we kind of step beyond the ones that are literally saying, look, this is a falsified kind of fictionalized space of a graphic user interface, if we step beyond those examples, nonetheless, we can still find a lot of overlaps between sort of the graphic user interface and a whole bunch of other contemporary media.
So in fact, I'd like to do exactly that, step beyond those examples, helpful and interesting as they are. I'd like to kind of take that provocation and take that step. Can we talk about sound design and the echoes that we hear literally from the graphic user interface in terms of sound design and other media?
Yes. Yeah. And this is like, I really enjoyed writing. So there's a chapter on sound, and sound is referred to across the book, perhaps not as extensively as I would like, or perhaps it should be, but I was new to sort of sound studies, but gosh, what an interesting field. And I just really enjoyed doing that research and kind of challenging myself to listen, not just to look. So all of my work previously had been about kind of visual aesthetics, And then to force myself to pay attention to the way those kind of visual elements are connected to the sonic environment. So kind of to zeroing in on that. And I've been told that some of the thinking here is a little unconventional, but I stand by it.
We like the unconventional.
Yeah, like if people disagree, that's fine. So the proposal being that kind of sound within the graphic user interface is all about navigation. So sure, when we're watching a YouTube video or having a Skype call or whatever, the audio we hear is of the media. You know, we're watching a film, we hear the soundtrack of the film through our graphic user interface, through the speakers. But outside of those kinds of moments, the sounds that the graphic user interface makes are all about kind of telling us where to look and what to look at. So think about when your email notification pings, or you get a kind of indication of a social media announcement or something, again, that might ping up, make some kind of audio notification. Or if you're trying to click on something and the computer's freezing up and it's buffering, and every time you click, it makes that kind of terrifying kind of noise. All of these kinds of noises, they're very minimal. We could almost ignore them, even though they're kind of vying for our attention. But we could kind of not think of them as significant. But I think there's a kind of fascinating aspect there to the graphic user interface as an environment where sound is all about kind of pointing a big arrow saying, look, you've got an email, because it's that you hear this noise ping at the same time that the notification kind of pops up, and therefore your eyes are drawn to the notification because you've also kind of heard this sound. And this all might sound kind of like, well, yeah, so what? Who cares? But then if you start kind of listening to especially kind of mainstream, big budget, kind of busy films and TV shows, they have a weirdly similar sound approach. Now, it's much more complex. It's much more nuanced. There's a lot more going on, sure. But if you've got like all of your Avengers in a Marvel film, if you've got all the Avengers coming together and there's a big battle, sound design is so crucial to telling the viewer what is happening during that fight. And so each character has a very specific sound cue or set of sound cues associated with them. So as you're watching all of these people kind of run around and shoot each other, these sounds that you hear are notifying you as to which character you're looking at and precisely kind of what's going on. Are they shooting their repulsor blasts, or have they crashed into a building or whatever it is? So yeah, again, that might seem like, well, obviously, Nick, like sound design in films, TV shows, video games, other places is all about kind of reflecting in audio what we're looking at with our eyes. Sure. But there's something kind of very overdetermined, very kind of highly specified to the use of sound in this. You know, we have these kind of digital multi-layered soundtracks today, which are very complex, but that complexity is led by a desire to orient our attention to specific things that are going on. And indeed, yeah, video games are a really good kind of example of this, because we can think of the soundscape in video games as functioning as part of the video game's interface. The sound is giving us information about the world as much as kind of on-screen interface elements that might be telling us kind of how much ammo we have left, or what weapon we're using, or whether our character is running out of stamina or whatever. All of the things I've just described are connected to specific sounds. So when we're kind of in the throng of some immediate gameplay, we are seeing important information, but we're also hearing a kind of confirmation, backup, kind of redundancy, kind of support of that information in our ears. So video games are using sound to kind of help us play them better. And I think that's then, if we start going listening for that kind of sound design in films and TV, we can hear it. We can hear a similar kind of approach to orienting the viewer, guiding attention in a way which is subtly different to soundscapes that have come before. Like there is a kind of focus on particular sound objects and a particular kind of way that soundscapes are being mixed in order to foreground those kinds of sound effects, which I argue kind of function themselves as notifications or kind of pings or kind of pop-ups that are guiding us, telling us what's going on in a particular scene. I'm one of the unfortunate people who watched Zack Snyder's Rebel Moon Part 1 a couple of months ago, and there's a fight scene in that which you could close your eyes and you would know exactly what was happening in that fight scene, because every time someone throws a punch in slow motion or picks up a gun, the audio of that movement, the kind of whoosh or the kind of clanking of someone, you know, a hand grabbing metal, is so overdetermined, is so hyper clear that, yeah, the soundscape alone tells you exactly what is happening and therefore is kind of supporting, guiding the images, which therefore, you know, there's an argument that then that is partly what has allowed kind of contemporary film and TV editing to become a bit looser, a bit less focused on kind of classical continuity as we would understand it, because the sound is doing more work to guide the viewer's attention, and therefore the editing, the framing, the composition doesn't have to do as much of that work. But maybe that's a whole other kind of segment to the argument that I won't get into right now.
Well, no, that's interesting to kind of pose and put out there and kind of see what happens. So thank you for, you know, putting that out there for us to consider. I want to kind of think about this idea of guiding viewers a bit further, because obviously there's elements you've talked about in terms of video games, you know, what is your character doing, what the capabilities are, the example you've just given of films and the impact on editing. Can we talk about VFX, video special effects breakdowns? Because in some ways this is like super niche. On the other hand, I know of at least one listener who definitely does watch these kinds of YouTube videos. Can you walk us through what is significant and impactful about these, especially in the context of the kind of idea of guiding that you've just brought up?
Sure. And hi VFX listener. Good to have you. A niche form, VFX breakdowns being these kind of videos that you can find on mostly YouTube, but other websites, and especially like the corporate websites of kind of visual effects companies themselves. And they'll be sort of 3, 4, 6 minutes long, and will show you how, quote unquote, kind of how the special effects, the CGI, the computer generated imagery of a given film or television show or occasionally video game has been put together. So they're like behind the scenes. They're telling you, this is how we did it. I'm fascinated in them. I'm always interested in watching the ones for films or TV shows that I'm particularly kind of fond of, just curious as to kind of what elements were visual effects and kind of how they've been put into the image. But there was a moment about four years ago in my institution. We had a guest speaker who was doing a masterclass. They worked for ILM, Industrial Light and Magic, and they were talking about the visual effects of a recent film that ILM had worked on. And they were showing us basically VFX breakdowns on our big cinema screen. And they looked great. Like, I'm a big fan of the film they were talking about. And so I was like, wow, this is wonderful to see how these special effects were put together. And then it just dawned on me, like, actually, I've got no idea how these special effects were put together. I don't know what I'm looking at. And as I've said, at the top of the show, I'm not a technical specialist. I don't do programming. I can't build things in Unity. So perhaps these videos speak very differently to someone who creates visual effects themselves and has seen, has kind of worked on visual effects using various programs. But they are seen much wider than that. They have this much, much wider audience. Like the breakdown for The Avengers has been seen something like 10 million times if you look at the YouTube views. So they have wider audiences. And yet, what are they telling us? They kind of show visual effects in their kind of rudimentary form, which is this kind of grayscale, kind of untextured kind of contoured shapes, and then they'll be like, they'll freeze the image, and then there'll be like these wipes which add kind of smoke effects, or which add particular textures, and then the image will freeze again, and then this kind of virtual camera will sort of unlatch from the image and show that the image is made up of kind of multiple layers, and some of which are kind of completely digital layers, and then the image will kind of get stitched back together and then start playing again. And it's all tremendously kind of appealing to watch. They're very they're gorgeous aesthetic objects, but it was interesting for me to think about, well, maybe if we focus on them as aesthetic objects and think about them as telling a story about visual effects, rather telling a story about how we think about visual effects rather than telling us how those visual effects were themselves made. And once I started kind of digging into that, that ended up kind of being very connected to the work on the graphic user interface, because what a visual effects breakdown is kind of doing is turning a finished composite shot that's designed to be a kind of realistic part of a finished text, and is giving the user a kind of navigable access to that. Suddenly, the single shot becomes a series of different planes or program windows, essentially, and it's kind of pulled apart so that the viewer can kind of implicitly navigate through it themselves, even though like they can't, because it's a finished kind of rendered video. But it's asserting this idea that the digital image is made up of these various different components which exist in this kind of space, which is at once kind of deep but also flat. And all of that to me just seems really connected to the graphic user interface, and the VFX breakdowns are kind of an example of graphic user interface imagination, or the graphic user interface imaginary kind of becoming fundamental to this relatively niche but kind of crucial format for how we think about digital effects today. And then once you sort of do that work, you can find moments in finished films themselves which then are kind of adopting a VFX breakdown approach, and therefore kind of also integrating the graphic user interface into how they're working, into their kind of finished aesthetic. So there's a film that I'm kind of reasonably obsessed with, Spider-Man Far From Home, which is the second Tom Holland Spider-Man film, in which Jake Gyllenhaal is the villain Mysterio. And he's this disgruntled VFX worker. He's been fired by Tony Stark. He doesn't have any superpowers. He's not magical, but he's trying to convince people that he does have superpowers using his visual effects skills. And so therefore there are moments where that film talks about the creation of visual effects within its narrative, even as it is also a kind of major blockbuster that relies very heavily on visual effects. And so there's sequences in the finished film that are almost identical to sequences in the film's own VFX breakdown, which is dismantling the VFX. And I find all that kind of really interesting, that kind of meta, kind of almost recursive, these moments where the text is kind of thinking about its own conditions of production. And I think, the emphasis on digital imagery and the creation of kind of computer-generated images kind of is innately connected to the graphic user interface, because this is where these images are produced. Yeah, this is where we're using online programs, Unity, Unreal, and so on, to create these images. And therefore, it's no surprise that then the GUI is kind of shaping how those appear in the final text, and kind of this GUI imaginary making itself present there in sometimes kind of subtle or roundabout ways, but they're there if you go looking for them, I think.
Well, in fact, I'd like to go looking for them in another sort of, I guess, medium, I suppose, because exactly what you've just discussed there with that, I mean, that film being kind of such a clear example of it, but obviously in other places as well, you talk about in the book sort of similar ideas about the use of particular softwares and GUIs having impacts on representations, not just in films, but also for built space. Can you talk about this part?
Yeah, this is so the last the last two or three chapters of the book, I tried to push the thinking a bit further and step beyond the screen. So rather than, you know, a lot of the book focuses on the aesthetics of finished media texts and kind of various things connected to them. But then in the last few chapters, I wanted to kind of pull attention away from the screen, look at things outside of the screen, but that are nonetheless still getting shaped by the screen, by the GUI. And so one of the things, or kind of the beginning of that, was to think about how the graphic user interface changes the way we think about built space, about the environments that we live in, about our surroundings, about our cities. And we might kind of start off thinking about this with like whenever you need to get somewhere and you're somewhere unfamiliar or you're going somewhere you haven't been to before, what do? You type the address into Google Maps or an app of your choice, and you press search and you see the map. You see a thing that shows you probably an aerial view of the city and a little line that kind of says you need to go this way. And then you can adapt that view so that maybe it's a street view, so it shows you footage or still images of these streets that have been captured by like the Google kind of street view cars that go around with those cameras capturing everything and then blurring out people's faces. So the way we then navigate the city, the way we find our way around, is aided in this instance by the graphic user interface. But then that in itself starts to shape our broader imaginations of the city, and in some cases, kind of the way that cities sort of get built. And we can see traces of this kind of imagination, this kind of graphic user interface, urban imagination, in certain films and other texts. So things like Inception, the Christopher Nolan film, or Doctor Strange, where you have characters rearranging the city. So they can kind of swipe their hands as though they're using like a touch screen, and they can pick up a building and they can move it over there, or they can kind of bend and fold space. So that seems maybe quite different to navigating from A to B. But the argument is that essentially the city around us becomes this highly personalized, flexible environment. So I can create my own city by going on Google Maps and just looking for a particular kind of business. Like, I just want to know where the coffee shops are. I just want to know where the restaurants are or whatever. And then Google gives me a customized, personalized, you know, it's got cookies that have been tracking what kind of coffee shops I like. So it gives me a version of my surroundings that are entirely kind of personalized to me. And therefore that kind of changes the shape of the city in my imagination. It becomes essentially kind of filtered through this graphic user interface. I argue that in these other texts where you see characters moving the city around and kind of having the ability to customize it in much more radical ways, that is a kind of just a scaling up of this idea that we have a kind of customized access to the city now. Mm-hmm. Yeah. And then there's a kind of connected part of that argument, which is about architecture and kind of the rise of particular forms of building that are entirely reliant on digital systems for their creation. So this kind of architecture called parametric or topological architecture, which if people kind of don't know what those words are pointing to, fair enough, but you might imagine those buildings that have been constructed in the last sort of 10, 20 years maybe, that are kind of globular, that are kind of big blobby shapes, or that have kind of radical diagonal ribbon effects, or that have some kind of trypophobic mesh kind of across them. these kind of very contemporary, very sexy, very kind of exciting new pieces of architecture, which are designed by kind of digital software, which now are also existing within our built space. But I think that's kind of fascinating, where they are. The aesthetic of these buildings is to me kind of innately connected to the graphic user interface. They are digital buildings. Yes, they are physical structures existing in the world, but they want us to kind of feel as though they are still digital somehow, like they've been 3D printed, like they could just as easily be retextured at the touch of a button, even though they're already built. You know, this is not how we kind of imagine or conceive of like a brick building structure or a stone building structure or something like that. These buildings feel almost arbitrary, like you could kind of rearrange them, yeah, at the touch of a button. So there's not, you know, this is not, depending on where you live, there are not millions of these buildings around, although, you know, sort of more global cities have more of them. But they do kind of, they are nonetheless kind of reshaping urban space in a way which pushes it again, sort of towards the graphic user interface or towards thinking about our physical surroundings as being much more closely connected to the desktop than maybe we might intuitively think.
Mm. Thank you for taking us through both of those pieces, the kind of how it changes our imagination of built space and what it's doing to change, you know, actual physical structures as well. Definitely some interesting things to kind of see how they continue to develop. And speaking of that kind of development aspect, can I ask you about something that I think might be sort of right at the front of assumptions of what this kind of topic is? But your book, and I know other work in this area, is kind of helpfully complicating some of these assumptions. I'm talking about VR. To what extent is VR a significant break from the graphic user interface we've been discussing so far?
Great question. Yeah. So the subject of the final substantive chapter of the book is VR. And that is because there's a lot of conversation, a lot of kind of discourse around VR being, what are our assumptions around VR? What might our kind of, why would we use VR rather than something else? Because it's more immersive, right? Because we put on this virtual reality being kind of defined here as headsets that we put on that provide us access to this kind of other space, whether it's kind of a filmed space that's then been stitched into this 360 degree world or a kind of digitally created 360 space, whether it's one that just allows us to look around the environment or one that allows us to move. You know, if you can get VR that's kind of set up within a room and then you can kind of step around this virtual environment. But so that would seem to be a very different experience to opening up our laptop and looking at a 13 or 15 inch screen. Like, that VR is a world. It's an enveloping space. It's not a small flat rectangle that we have to engage with using a mouse and keyboards and trackpads. VR is something we are inside. That's the kind of argument or the claim that VR is often connected to, or the claims that are made around VR. But I argue in the book that's not entirely true. I think that VR is best thought of, or that a useful kind of corrective or balancing out of some of the kind of hype around VR is to think about it as just one more graphic user interface. So all this talk about VR and kind of spatial transportation and envelopment and immersion, yes, sure, but also VR is two screens. It's just that they're really close to your face. You know, you put on a VR headset and you are looking at screens. You're not inside space. You're looking at two screens that are only like an inch from your eye, rather than like when you're looking at a laptop and it's a bit further away from your eyes. So yeah, this has kind of major kind of phenomenological and affective consequences in that you feel surrounded and there's this kind of immersive quality to it. But if we nonetheless focus on the kind of screenness of virtual reality, then we can kind of start to read the space that it presents as being, yeah, another graphic user interface. It is a representational space that the user is then interfacing with through prompts. They might be kind of these pop-up direction things, like a big orange arrow that sort of says go here or click this or whatever. Or it might be more subtle things like kind of audio cues that are guiding your attention, telling you, oh, the thing that's interesting is happening behind you, so you know you should turn around because the sound is kind of telling you to do that. And again, these are I've sort of talked about these things already, and so they're things that are happening, or the graphic user interface is doing, and then VR is also doing them. It's sort of taking these devices, these ways of guiding our attention and providing us a space to interface with. So yeah, my basic claim is that we need to take a big step back from this idea that VR is something significantly, fundamentally, epistemologically different. That's not to say it doesn't have its own distinctive qualities and that it doesn't kind of yet work in its own ways, but there's this risk that we fall into a very kind of industry-led hype around virtual reality. So thinking about it as a kind of another version of the graphic user interface, or at the very least as a technology which is embedded within this graphic user interface culture, if we think of VR as a GUI technology, essentially, that's a helpful corrective and stops us kind of overclaiming for the things that virtual reality can do. And that's a big part of kind of what I focus on in the book, but also like in my teaching and other stuff, is I try and kind of step away from hype when we're talking about these kind of new technologies, when we're talking about digital systems, kind of digital networks, tools, what they can do, what they can give us, how they can change our lives. It's so important to acknowledge the hype, acknowledge the way that's shaping wider discourse and kind of technological development, but also like to think in other ways, to explore technology kind of shorn from that perhaps over optimism or indeed over pessimism, and to kind of find a slightly different way of thinking about it. So yeah, that's the work on VR, is my attempt to kind of temper some of the hype around VR by thinking of it kind of through this lens of the graphic user interface. And I mean, I'm not the only one who's kind of pushing against the hype of VR, of course, and there's some incredible work by Lisa Nakamura and Kate Nash, and I use them in the chapter to help me kind of think about the actual realities of VR as opposed to its kind of hype.
So I think that's some really useful things for people to think about next time they might encounter this VR hype. What else do you want readers to consider next time they engage with GUIs?
Oh, what a question. To consider the GUI, like full stop, whether that goes anywhere or kind of what anyone does with that, I think that's the starting point, right? And the hope is that there might be some people out there who kind of find the book useful to pull attention towards the graphic user interface. So to see that thing, which is absolutely central, integral to our media ecology today, but which we so rarely pay any attention to. You know, there's so much work around like the Netflix algorithm or streaming cultures and all of that stuff. But like, what about the interface which is providing this content? What about the interface which is putting a Netflix TV show side by side with a Disney Plus film, a YouTube sort of fan video, and collects all of those things together on the same screen and allows us to kind of jump between them at ease, at our will, kind of customize our media space. So paying attention to the effects of the interface, which is like a notoriously kind of difficult thing to do, or at least sort of unintuitive, because the point of an interface is not to be noticed. You know, it allows, it interfaces us with our media. It's not designed to get in the way. The more we notice it, the less well it's functioning, because by definition, a good interface is one that disappears, supposedly. When we're talking about like critical theory that's looking at digital media or this kind of digital media ecology, I would just, I kind of ask or invite people to include this kind of attention to the gooiness of the media that they're looking at as part of their analysis, because I think it's crucial. I think it's fundamental, albeit in subtle and sometimes minor, but overwhelmingly kind of present ways. It's shaping what we look at, what we listen to, how we look at it, how we listen to it. And therefore, it's important to kind of factor it in when we're looking at digital media. So that's what I would invite readers to do after they finish the book.
Well, speaking of finishing the book, that does lead us right to the end of the interview with the final question. Given the number of things that you're helping listeners, readers think through, what might you be thinking through now that this is done? Are there any projects you're working on or that you want to highlight or preview for us?
So I'm starting to get a project up and running, which is around quantum physics. So, you know, nothing heavy next up. Because there's a lot of media out there, and again, kind of it's film, TV, video games, it's a whole bunch of stuff, which is working with multiverses, which is working with time loops. And these are ideas which are coming from a certain model of the universe, which is quantum physics, quantum mechanics. So this feels like a really fun, interesting, exciting project, and it feels like there's a lot of strands to it. So I'm at the beginning of this kind of, what might be called quantum media project, addressing kind of why these ideas, why now? You know, why are there so many multiverses across various kind of comic book properties or Rick and Morty or Everything Everywhere All at Once? You know, there's multiverses everywhere. There's time loops everywhere. And what's going on there? I'm kind of really fascinated by it. Started trying to learn some quantum physics. That's challenging, but it's occasionally bears some fruit. I'm hoping to be kind of working on that for the next few years. And indeed, something I really want to do with that is work with other people, is pull together networks and create like a network of interested scholars, and then maybe kind of think about edited collections on the topic. So it's very early days, but if anyone listening is kind of working on this sort of thing, or is a media theorist or kind of works on film, TV, video games, and thinks maybe they'd love to do something around multiverses or time loops, then do get in touch, because that's kind of what I'm at the beginning of right now, and I'm really excited about it.
What a fun project and invitation. Thank you for closing us off with that, leaving me just to remind listeners that the book we've been discussing is titled GUI Media, Screen Entertainment and the Graphic User Interface, published by Edinburgh University Press. Nick, thank you so much for being with us on the podcast.
Thank you, Miranda. It's been so nice just talking about the project. Thanks for all the questions, and thanks everyone for listening as well.